Welcome to the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast with Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Using an interview format, Pastor Bob will introduce you to men and women whose ministries are impacting this world with the gospel, and will also provide commentary and insight on end-time prophetic events we now see happening in the news. Now here is Pastor Robert Thibodeau.
Hello, everyone, everywhere. This is Pastor Robert Thibodeau. I want to thank you for joining us today on the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast. With everything going on in the world right now, not just in the United States, but the world, many people are wondering, what's next? Are we at the end of days? Well, to help us gain a better understanding of all these things, I've invited back on the program our good friend Stan Dale. Now, for those that have just started following us since the last time Stan was on the program, let me tell you just a little bit about Stan Dale. Stan has held an above top secret security clearance before. He's worked undercover for the FBI. He's worked on an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller and specialized in the development of flying soft saucer technology. And as far out as that may seem on the surface, wait until you hear his story. And we've talked extensively about this in our prior interviews. You can hear them in episodes 272, 273, and 274. Stan's been called the real-life Indiana Jones, but he says he actually knows who the real Indiana Jones is. Amen? Stan has done extensive research and discovered the biblical Garden of Eden, and it was verified by a Discovery Channel special on the project, I believe. He's done research on the lost city of Atlantis. He's has interesting information on Tesla projects and has done work and lectured on different world events, including the coming global economic collapse, the developing solar-related crisis and Earth's climate, UFO deception and the real intent behind it, the destruction of America by a civil war followed by a foreign invasion, and more that we'll probably end up talking about if we have time. I say that because every time Stan comes on the program, you really never know where the conversation is going to go. Now, Stan's wife is Holly Dale, and she has a very important part in everything Stan does as well. Holly finds and presents links to news stories that are pertinent to biblical prophecy for the day and time we find ourselves in today. And she posts them 6 days a week, praise God. Holly's also the author of 5 books, and if I'm not mistaken, met Stan through an appearance on the Coast to Coast AM program with the original host, Art Bell. Now, as they say, the rest is history. And Stan has released a book called The Cosmic Conspiracy. And listen to me here. He predicted in this book many of the things we see happening right now. Well, Brother Bob, what's so special about that? Because the book was written in 1978. That's how long he's been talking about this. Amen. Stan is a one of a kind. I'm so blessed to have him as a friend of this ministry. Now, help me welcome back to the program, Stan Dale. Stan, thank you so much for coming back on the program today.
Thank you, Bob. Good to talk to you again. It seems like yesterday, and then yet it seems like a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, amen. It sure does. You know, it's been a little over 2 years since we talked. I mean, episode 272 is almost 600 episodes ago for us. Yeah. And for the sake of our new listeners who may not have had a chance to hear our prior interview, I just want to recap a little bit before we start talking about current events and the new company you're with, and et cetera. As I was reading up in prep for today's interview, I read something I did not know about you, and I want to start with that because tell me how you received written permission as a fourth-class cadet at the Air Force Academy to sit at ease during meals and drink coffee.
Well, to the outsiders, that probably doesn't mean a big deal, but as a fourth-classman in West Point or Air Force Academy or your Naval Academy, any of these, you don't have many rights. You're just a squat, a plebe, yeah. You know.
And a plebe,
go to mealtime, you have a table commander, which is an upperclassman, and maybe two or three upperclassmen sitting around the table, but then you have the fourth classman, and you're kind of lower than a dog's body in the chain of command. So you eat square meals. In other words, you sit at a brace, hands to the side, but they come up in right angle movements. If you want to put something in your mouth, you have to follow this path up in front of your eyes and over into your mouth and down, and everything's a kind of, you know, a routine, like a salute almost, to get it in your mouth. And you're then asked table knowledge by your table commander. He said, you know, tell us about, you know, this bomber of that situation, and it's in your book of knowledge, and you have to recite it. And hopefully you get to take a bite of your dinner sometime or your breakfast. Anyway, one of these times I was sitting at my table there, and my table commander in that particular day was, well, for that month even, was a rather nasty table commander. He enjoyed, you know, plebes or fourth class cadets in this case. He enjoyed poking them, you know, and causing them to miss their meal. And in this particular time, he was going around one by one to us fourth classmen on the table, saying, okay, you know, Blogs over there, I want you to send me a picture of your girlfriend, preferably one in a bathing suit. And he went around telling each one something like that. And he got to me and he says, well, now, Deo, okay, what's your girlfriend like? I said, well, sir, I don't have one. What? Well, you're going to have to send me something. Figure out somebody important and get them to send me a picture of them. I said, well, yes, sir. And then we went back to eating, and that was that. So I went back to my room, and I thought, somebody important, but I don't have a girlfriend. Important, the head of Strategic Air Command, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Curtis LeMay. He's important. So I drafted this letter by hand, because in those days, computers weren't, you know, part of the game. And I said, you know, look, sir, this is just a bit of fun. I thought, I told him what I just told you about my table commander. And I said, since I didn't have a girlfriend, and he said, I have something important. I said, I hold you to be one of the most important people in the country now. And I sealed it up and took it to the post office there on our floor. And as I was putting it in the mail chute and it sank down, the postmaster came to the window and he said, oh, you're sending a letter to General. Oh, the last guy that did it last year was court-martialed out. And I said, oh, well, give it back to me. So I'm sorry. He said, once it gets into the system, I can't give it back to you. Uh-oh. So I sweated it for a week, maybe 10 days. I thought, boy, it's going to be coming, and I'm gone from here. And so fortunately, General LeMay had a good sense of humor. And he wrote back to me. You know, he said, look, this is a permission slip for a cadet fourth class Deo to drink coffee anytime he wants. Well, that meant you could sit at ease and just, you didn't have to eat square meals, you know. You were kind of exempt from a lot of that horse stuff. Anyway, I put it into my tunic and out of sight, and I went to the next meal, and I was waiting for that guy to say to me, where's your, you know, picture or your photograph of an important person, whatever. It didn't happen that meal. Next meal, it didn't happen. So a couple of days went by, and I kept carrying that thing in my vest pocket, thinking, he's going to ask me today. He's going to ask me. Finally, the day came. And to my left was a upperclassman at the same level as the table commander. So the table commander said, well, Dale, where's your photo or something from, you know, somebody important? I said, right here, sir. So I reached in my tunic and I passed the letter over to the cadet to the left of me. And he opened it up to read it first. And he said some things like, golly, in more explicit terms. Is this real? And I said, yes, sir, it is. Wow. So he passes over the table commander. Table commander looks at it. And his face goes white. And he says, gentlemen, let's salute Cadet Deo. He to God and live to survive it. I tell you what, it was legend in all, because on the weekends you mixed tables with the other squadrons and had different table commanders. And it got to the point where I would just start to pull that out, and the table commander said, oh, I know you. Never mind. Everyone, all cadets sit at ease. You know, because of that letter. So,
oh, that's hilarious. It reminded me when I was applying for officer candidate school, and it was a little over 8 years, going on nine, as enlisted. And you know, I was applying, I had to have someone field grade or above write a letter of recommendation, and it could not be in my chain of command. And you know, I was an air defense enlisted man at a transportation base as a drill instructor, drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had nobody who knew me to even write a letter of recommendation at that post. And I was out for a run one day, wondering how I'm going to do this. And I ran by this brigade headquarters, and there's a one-star flag flying out front. And this guy's not in my chain of command. But, yeah, you know, I always lived my adage, you know, as, you know, but all they can do is say no. You just ask, right. And all they can do is say no. So I'm all sweaty. I walk in, and you know, the secretary is there in this nice plush office, and she goes, can I help you? And I said, I'd like to make an appointment with the general for a letter of recommendation for Officer Candidate School. And I figured, you know, we just make the appointment, and I'd be out And I hear this booming voice behind me. Do I know you? I turn around. Here's this like 6'6", lineman from a football team or something. And he's looking down at me. He said, do I know you? And I turn around, took a big swell. I said, no, sir. But I quickly explained the situation like I did. And he's like, that takes balls to walk in here like that. Make him an appointment. So I was like, wow. And I made the appointment, got my letter of recommendation. When I submitted it, my commander was laughing. He goes, you know you're in. I was, well, I don't know. We'll send it off and see. No. It's lieutenant colonels trying to make colonel that is on the board of selection. And you have a general telling them they need to select you. You are in, because there's no lieutenant colonel who's going to tell the general he's full of crap. Right? And sure enough, I got selected.
Same club, Bob. Same club. Wow. Wow.
That's amazing. That is so cool. And when you were going through that story, I'm like, oh, yeah. And that OCS, one of my classmates, his dad, because he had to write a bio, your first day there and stuff. And his dad was a 4-star general, right? But he didn't, nobody had caught on during the application process. I guess, well, it came out in the bio. Morning number two is the tacks are coming out to give you harassment and all that. As soon as they hit the deck, all they did, they started yelling his name. I can't remember what his name was now, but I'll say Mason. Say, Mason, drop and start knocking them out. 10 for every star, and you know what we're talking about. but guess who the guest speaker was at our graduation?
So, who?
The 4-star general. That is so cool. Well, Fox News and other media. Well, let's back up a little bit further. I mentioned your work with Dr. Teller, but I didn't go into specifics. Can you share with us, again, because some people are just listening for the first time, that story again in order to set the stage for some of the other things that we'll be talking about concerning UFOs and all that stuff?
All right. Well, back in 1971, I was approached in Dallas where I was working in the computer field. I was employed at Lee Optical Affiliates as a senior systems analyst to run their systems. And I had a few of the employees underneath me on my floor there where I was. And I was visited one day by the FBI. A couple of agents came in and wanted to recruit me to be their eyes and ears on this company because of some illegal arms transfers that were occurring in the Middle East and illegal communications with the head of state, Golda Meir at the time, to people that own this company. So I agreed. And that was kind of the point in time when I kind of touched base with the intelligence community, just briefly. And I reported things I was supposed to and things like that. And I had one of the guys that worked for me was a former Strategic Air Command aircraft commander, Colonel Dice. And I had a big blackboard in my office, and I'd call the staff in, and we'd talk about things that we were supposed to do for the job. But when we were there, nearly 20 hours a day sometimes at night, there was nobody in the whole building except us, and we'd talk about what we wanted to. And I'd been designing a method of building a saucer-shaped craft to run on what's called a plasma drive. And I talked with George about this because he was Strategic Air Command, and drew pictures on the board, and he says, I'm going to tell you something. And of course, he's older than me, even though he worked for me, he's older than me. And he said, when I was the commander of the aircraft, he said, I had a navigator who was a researcher at home in electronics. And he gave me one day a letter sealed and stamped and everything, and so that if you broke the seal, that somebody would know. And he said, George, I'm going to give you this. I'm going to tell you what's in there, and I'll show you with a copy of it here. I want you to keep this for me if something happens to me. And it was a patent application that his navigator was making to patent an anti-gravity device. Mm. And I said, George, have you still got that letter? I'd like to see that. He said, no, actually, it's down at my parents' home in Florida. And I had him check later, but I figured we might be able to get a copy of it and see what it was all about. And he said, well, I'll tell you what it's about. I'll draw the pictures up here. So he drew pictures up there of a wedding cake type thing made out of a chipboard, just composite wood in the shape of circles, three layers high, and on each layer, there was on the edge of it, there were sets of a rod, an iron rod with a coil wrapped around it, just one layer. And that connected to a split washer that the rod went through. And I think these things are probably available on one of my websites here on show images somewhere or another, pictures of it. If not, I can send it to people. But anyway, he showed me all that, and he said, that's what the guy drew. He didn't give me the circuit, but he said, here's what's happening to him. He said that Navigator was at home, and he was researching this design with these, like, iron rod candles with coils and stuff around it, the periphery of it. And he turned on his circuit, which was connected to this platform of stuff. And the circuit was connected by one of these knife blade connectors, you know, so that you lift it up and there's about a 3-inch gap in the air so that you've completely disconnected mm-hmm. this circuit. You do that usually when you're working with something with high voltage. So you've got a bit of separation, you know, and the voltage can't drop across it. Well, he closed the circuit and he looked at the thing sitting on his desk and nothing happened. And he was about to go over there and turn it off and think, where did I go wrong, when he saw it start to vibrate a bit on the table. He thought, oh, well, that's interesting. And as it vibrated, then it started to stabilize and start to rise up slowly off the top of the desk into the air. Mm. Well, now that's interesting, he said. Yeah. So he lets it keep on going, and he realizes he's going to run out of wire pretty soon connected to the knife blade switch over there. So he thought, well, he looked underneath the platform, the anti-gravity platform, and the air inside of it was like wavy, like there was, you know, like typical force mm-hmm. field looking things on TV. And he said, well, gee, that's probably got charge in it. I'll go over here and disconnect the knife blade. So he disconnects the knife blade, except it doesn't stop. An arc of like 75 to 100,000 volt arc at least jumps across the blades and stays connected to the circuit. It's like you've created the monster, it won't let you turn it off.
Wow.
And he thought, goodness gracious, what do I do now? It's still climbing toward the center of the room here, up toward the ceiling. And he said, I took a wooden broomstick, because it wouldn't conduct electricity normally. He said, so I took a mighty swing underneath that thing through that field, and it caused the field to buckle, and the platform started to fall back toward the table, all in a flash of a second, he said, because when I did that, electric arcs flew all over my circuit back over there. It was connected by the knife blade still, well, the air knife blade gap. And he said, boom, all the power went out in the house. And he said, oh, you know, something expedited, deleted. And he realized he was going to have to rebuild stuff that was fried in that the next day. Well, next day, he gets a knock on the door from the power company and said, sir, did you have any problem with your power last night? He said, oh, yeah, it just all went off all of a sudden. What happened? And they said, well, sir, that transformer outside your house on the pole there received an excessive voltage that went down the line and burned out this one and a lot of your neighbor's power. Gosh, really? Well, I don't know what caused that. Maybe a lightning strike or something. And anyway, he got away with it. But this was the patent he was giving to Colonel Geist, to George. And so George told me all that stuff. And I started to then include that in my own research at home into propulsion system. Originally, I was looking at plasma drives. But if this did create anti-gravity, I tried to reason why it interacted with gravity with magnetic fields and started to build a test, which I did do. Now, I didn't tell anybody about this mm-hmm. at all. And it's a complex coil on my desk. And I was going to feed in, you know, pulses of direct current to it. And it was a complex coil, which very much was similar, but one single coil to what the Navigator developed. Well, as I punched it on for, I don't know, a fraction of a second or a few seconds, what I could see in the room around me, what my eyes were beholding in the wall and the doors and stuff in front of me in my laboratory there at home, it is though I rolled over head first and everything in the room, all the images of whatever I was looking at, warped or bent in toward where the coil was. Wow. And I felt nauseous. And then all of a sudden it burned out. The coil wasn't able to take that. And it was back to normal. And I could never get it to work in that same spot again. It was like I burned out a hole to the parallel universes. I mean, it didn't work there, but you could do it again in another part of the room. Anyway, so that was, now I was looking at something that was really quite extraordinary. Well, one day, while I was there at the office there at the computer company, we had about 3,000 employees. I was down on the ground floor to the, employee, cafeteria. And I was the only one in there because it was not the normal time for, you know, the normal workers to go. I went in between hours so that I didn't have anybody bugging me. And I sat down at a table and had my coffee. And as I was drinking, I looked over the doorway to the cafeteria, and here comes this man. I think I'd seen him around at one of our insurance companies or something. You know, I thought, well, like, you know, it's somebody from up the top floor there. And he gets his coffee, and he comes walking straight for him. I'm the only one in the whole cafeteria, you know, in the table section. And he comes over to me and sits right down across from me. And he says, hello, I'm Ted Owanski. I said, okay. And he says, you're who now? And I said, Stan Deo. And he says, right, okay. No, that's right. He says, so what are you doing here? And I told him, and he got to talk about, well, what kind of things are you working on in your research? No, I said, oh, so a way to get power out of the atmosphere and how to propel things with a thing that defeats gravity and stuff like that. Because I figured this guy works as an actuary, you know, a numbers guy in an insurance company that this group owns. What does he's not going to be really interested in that. So he was European, Wonski, you know, from Poland, and he smoked his cigarettes in between the second and third fingers on the hand, you know, up to the face like they do in the movies. So he takes a drag on this thing and blows it off, and he says, gee, you know, let's hold that there for a second. Okay, I hung it up. Okay, you can get back on your tape recording there.
Go ahead.
So he said, you know, your research sounds really interesting. I have a friend of mine that'd be really interested in talking to you. And I said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, his name is Dr. Maxfield. I'm thinking, well, he's just a psychiatrist or something. You know, this guy probably thinks I'm nuts. And he scribbled his name and address down on this and phone number down this piece of paper that I put in my pocket. And he said, yeah, call Jim you know, get an appointment and go see him. He'd be really interested. And I said, oh, well, thanks. So I put it in the trash when I got back to my office and went on with normal life for about a month. And I went downstairs again at the off time to, you know, get a coffee. And it was all empty except for me down there. And darn if this guy doesn't come in again. He gets his coffee, comes down, sits across from me. He says, you know, I've talked to my friend Jim. You haven't contacted him. I've made an appointment for you this afternoon at 3 o'clock on Lemon Avenue. Where do you go now? You go see him. He wants to see you. I thought, right, this is weird. I've been dealing with the FBI, and we're looking at international stuff. You know, who is this guy? And it turns out he runs a radiation research clinic that he and his family own. And so I get to the address given to me, and I get out of my car, and it's in the afternoon, a little after 3, and I was the only car in the parking lot. And this building was kind of a long building. The windows, I didn't see many windows in it, but there was one door at the front. A single door, not any of these fancy corporate doors where you know, push a button and open everything. So I opened this door very carefully, and it, just like in the movies, it squeaked a bit on the hinges. So I like that, and I looked down this hallway way down there. There's no one in there except a little light in the side of the hallway down there, about halfway down the building. And there were a number of doors left and right. They were all closed, and so I don't know who was in those doors. And it's dark in this hallway. It wasn't even lit up except for that sunlight coming down the way there. So I thought, well, I've got to play this out and see what this is all about. Curiosity got the best of me. I walked on down the hallway, kind of listening for anybody behind me or anything else. And I get down there, and there's a reception station there, and the sunlight coming in from the side window on her desk was what I saw. But there was no receptionist. And I thought, yeah, I think I'm going to go back out the front door. I turned to go, and she came in from a side door right close to the desk there where she'd kind of been to the ladies' room or something. Oh, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm Stan Deo. Oh, yeah. Dr. Jim's expecting you. Okay, I said. Well, here I am. She said, he'll be right out. And I looked back down, further down the hallway, double doors like you'd see in a surgery room, or like an operating room. Mm-hmm. Bang, the doors come out, and this 6-foot-some-odd tall giant comes out, the military crew cut in a big cigar and cowboy boots and a white coat over the outside of his suit. Comes down there and he says, hey, boy, I've been expecting you, and come on in here to my office across from the reception desk. So there's a small office, you know, probably maybe 10 foot square or something, you know, 10 foot by 10 foot. And I said, sir, I don't really know why I'm really here. Ted Owanski said you were his friend and that you wanted to talk to me about something in my research. And with that, he says, well, you know, let me begin by saying I want to know what you're doing, but I better give you a little bit of a look at me. And he says, I'm in, you know, radiation research, and this is a research clinic. And we do things that are helping, people to get cured of cancer and stuff. And I said, oh, okay. So I'm thinking, what does this have to do with anti-gravity? He says, up here on the wall, see these photographs up on the wall? And I said, yeah. He said, that man with me there is Dr. Edward Teller. I assume you know who he is. I said, oh, yeah, the father of the hydrogen bomb. Yeah, didn't know you were friends with him. He said, well, we were drinking champagne. It was my first trip under the pole in a submarine with him. I said, ah, I'm thinking to myself, X-ray cancer research, taking a submarine under the pole. There's more to this guy than meets the eye. Look at all of his diplomas on the wall and stuff and other pictures of him and other people on the wall. And I'm thinking, wow. And he says, okay, now, boy, we're kind of interested in what you're doing because we actually have a research project that is parallel to what you've been doing in your lab at home. And at that moment, I suddenly hearkened back to a few weeks earlier when I was at the office, my neighbor at home rang and said, you better come home. Someone is breaking into your house in broad daylight and carrying stuff out. Mm. And so, you know, police were called and everything, and they were interrupted mid-progress and drove off. And a couple of things were missing, but they had broken into my laboratory. Mm. So I thought, this is how this guy knows what I've been doing, because I haven't told anybody about this part of it. And so I said, yeah, well, I've been, now, understand, I hadn't finished my degree or anything, and I'm talking to the guys that got multiple degrees and talking, you know, atom bombs, this kind of stuff, and you kind of feel like, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. So I said to him, well, look, I've been kind of researching some stuff like propulsion and gravity and electromagnetic. He said, look, don't hedge with me. We know you're working on anti-gravity. And that's what we're doing. We'd like to have you join our project. And I said, okay. I said, you know, I didn't finish my degree. He said, yeah, no, it doesn't matter. It's what you're doing. Okay. He said, let me make a call. I want to have you join our project down in Australia. And it gets even weirder, you're thinking. So he calls us the Australian consulate in, it might have been in Washington State. I'm not sure. Anyway, he calls and he says, look, this is Jim, Maxwell, Dr. Maxwell. And he said, I need to talk to whoever the guy was. I forget. It might have been Bob. But he says, I have another one of Maxfield's boys to send him. And basically what it meant was they were to set up a whole chain of events to have me get my health examination x-rays for TB and stuff so I could get into Australia. And this had an appointment for me and my wife and children to go to clear us to enter Australia. And about a month later, a lady rang from the consulate. She'd come out to Dallas and she says, okay, I'll meet you at the hotel at this time. Come on over. And when I was in the meeting with her, she talked to me, about various things technically that I was supposed to be cleared for that they were going to do with the exams there. And she says, now, how would you like to enter the country? What kind of occupation? I said, I've got computer skills and some electronics research. She's right. We're going to make you an electrical engineer. That's a category we need in Australia. And I said, and she said, that'll do fine. And so we were cleared and they purchased tickets to Australia on the airlines there. And we were told my wife and I not to talk to anyone about where we're going. And, it was now considered a classified operation. And so I left a week early. I had the tickets changed to let me leave a week early on the day I left with the family, thinking this is so weird that my plane might crash. You know, I wasn't sure what they were up to. And we arrived at about, 1 or 2 in the morning in Sydney at the airport here. And in those days, the airport was all closed down except, minimal lighting and stuff because they didn't operate at night, just during the daytime. And so we were sitting there on a bench, me and the wife and 2 kids, 2 young fellows, and this man comes walking in. You'd see he's a pilot in his uniform, and he comes walking over to us, and he says, hey, what are you guys doing? He said, oh, we're waiting for our connecting flight to Melbourne where we're supposed to go. And he says, oh, let me see your tickets. He says, hey, look, I'm heading down to Melbourne. I've got a flight that leaves before yours does, several hours. He said, come with me. I'll have one of the attendants over here at this ticket counter who's not doing much change this over, and I'll put you on our flight, and we'll fly you down. So I said, sure, okay, that'd be fine. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, who is this guy? I don't know from Adam, but, he's now changed my flight tickets and things. maybe that's a good thing, because if I am being tracked by people other than his people, they won't know that I've taken this flight. So I took the flight down with him and got into a taxi with the family. We went to what's called a hostel, and it was just a, you know, a place where people traveling the country as a tourist that didn't want to buy a big hotel room, you'd have these things with cots and stuff. So we went there and slept through probably a day. We were so tired. And one of the friends I'd made back at the company in Dallas, one of my, you know, civilian type friends, was a man who lived in Sydney originally. And he told me, when you get there, if you have any problems, contact this friend of mine. And so here's his number and his name. And I did that. And it was Charlie Parker. And he was just a good old guy that had investments in taxi cab licenses and used car business. And I told him where I was, and he came over immediately and took the family. And he said, look, you'll need a place to stay. You need a car. He said, I can get you a car. And just out of the goodness of his heart, he set us up and got us a home to rent and everything. And so that's how I got in there. And I didn't come through the chain of command to Sir John Williams, who was my contact that I was supposed to meet in Sydney, or sorry, in Melbourne. Okay, 6 months went by, and I got a job in the meantime with a tractor company. Who's our leading tractor company here anyway?
John Deere or something like that?
Yeah, John Deere, yeah. And so down there I was as a systems analyst with them for 6 months. And I figured, you know, I did some more paper research on what I've been working on back in the States. And I wrote a letter to Dr. Maxfield, and I said, Dr. Maxfield, I've been down here for a few months now, and I've got new thoughts, and I'm going to do a trial of something in the wiring here where I'm working now. And it was Caterpillar tractors, actually, not John Deere, Caterpillar. Anyway, I did run a test out there with some of their arc welders, you know, the transformers and things, managed to blow up something. It was not a big blow up, but enough that it was, you know, interesting. And I told him that I had this idea and maybe we ought to talk. And he said, gee, boy, where have you been? We've been looking for you for 6 months. And I said, well, I guess I missed the plane, or nobody picked me up, you know. And he said, all right, I want you to contact Sir John Williams at this phone number there in Melbourne. He's going to be your contact man, your control, in other words. And I will tell him we found you, and so call him at home. And I did do that. And, you know, Sir John said the same thing. We've been expecting you for 6 months. And meet me at the train station here in Melbourne. And I did. And he came with his driver, who, believe me, looked like Odd Job in the James Bond movies. And that one where they had the guy with the metal hat rim that threw it at people. Anyway, he was like an Odd Job guy, muscly and whatever. And he was the driver. And we went out outside the train station here into Mercedes. And Odd Job drove us down to a place called the Melbourne Club, where we sat down and talked about things, Sir John and I. And that was the initial meeting, and he wanted to see papers that I'd already sent to the aeronautical research labs there in Fisherman's Bend, Melbourne. And he looked at the drawings I had of the flying saucers and how the plasma craft worked, and he was thumbing through it. When he got to the cross section of it, he said, wow, can I have a copy of this? I said, well, yes, sir, that's your copy. I brought it for you. And he said, I'll review this. I've got to go to Jakarta this weekend, and I'll look at it and hand it over to my people for evaluation. And later, a few weeks later, he was back, and I had a meeting with the director of the Aeronautics Research Lab. But in those days, it's called a different name now, but Dr. Tom Keeble. And, you know, I went in to the appointment, and Keeble said he was a very narrow office. He had a couple of people come in. The guy that's now the current head of that department was just an analyst that was working for Tom. And we were sitting there. There was a window to the left of us. I could see down to the ground floor, which is, you know, we were up about two stories, I think. And I was asked, you know, by Dr. Keeble, he said, you know, tell me, how'd you get to this country? And I said, well, I flew in, and you know, I've been here a few months. And one of the three analysts or scientific people that were sitting to my right against the wall there said, did you say ASIO contacted you? And I said, ASIO, who's that? No. That's Australian Security Intelligence Organization, like they're kind of FBI, CIA combined. And okay. Our government, the CIA, had already set them up, established them. So that's why they were similar to CIA in their operation at that time. And there was a bookshelf in between these guys on my right there against the wall and to Dr. Keeble's desk. And the bookshelf had tapes and books and stuff all over it. And I said, okay, why are you asking? Oh, well, we're just curious. And I said, okay. I said, I guess I'm here because you guys are interested in my flying saucer type approach. It's kind of like copying what these UFOs we've heard about might be doing. And the director and all three of the men to the right there all looked at me, you know, at the same moment and waved their hands and put their fingers to their mouth and like, be quiet. And I said, okay. I said, well, are you guys familiar with this stuff? And they said, oh, yeah. I think it was Sale Air Force Base at the time. He said, we have videos of these craft. And, yeah, we're quite aware of that. I said, well, can I see your records and stuff and your videos? I'm really curious. And with that, they again put their fingers to their mouth and said, well, no, we can't do that. And they pointed up toward the bookshelf, you know, and to the ears. They were obviously were being monitored. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went home. We finished our meeting. And just as we finished the meeting, I saw a black limousine drive up to the first floor down there and to the window. And Dr. Keeble looked down there and said, oh, well, he's here now. I've got to go to lunch, guys. And the three scientists, one of them said, boy, are you lucky dog. I wish we could meet with him. I don't know who him was or what the deal was. But then he went off to his meeting. I went back to work. And maybe a couple of days only passed. And I had rented this home. Charlie Parker helped me to rent this home, which was on the one side of a trolley line that ran down the street, and the other across the street were other houses. And right across from me, there was another house that I hadn't met the people or anything. But anyway, evening came that day, and my wife said, at that time it was my former wife, she said, I need some cigarettes and, some hot chocolate and marshmallows and things. Go down the end of the block here to that, what do they call it? It's like a pop mom and pop shop. It's mm-hmm. like a deli, but only one couple owns it. It's a small, like, what you call it?
Convenience store type.
Yeah. And it was dark. So I walked on down there and stood in line, went inside and stood in line to order the cigarettes and hot chocolate and things. And I noticed the person behind me that came up, he got real close to my ear. And I felt uncomfortable because he's that close. And he says, do not turn around. You had a meeting today, or yesterday it was, with Dr. Keeble, and I want to talk to you about that, but not here, outside. When you finish and are walking back towards your house, I will join you. And then I felt him leave, you know, going back out the door. Well, I'll tell you what, the hairs in the back of my neck were now standing up. So I walk out the door with the goodies in the bag, and I'm looking, I don't see anybody, so I take maybe 10 or 15 steps to up the sidewalk here to the house, and heading for the house, and he joins me, and he comes up and he says, I'm your neighbor right across the street, and I'm also the one that they assigned your papers, you know, the flying saucer stuff, to my desk. It turns out to be the guy that invented the flight recorders that all the planes use today. Okay. And he said, for the first time in my history with the organization, Fisherman's Bend, he said, they pulled your papers off of me and said that I was not to talk to anybody about it, and that this would be handled at a higher level, you know, and that's where the classifications came in. But anyway, he said, I can't ask you to tell me anything about it. But he said, I'm very interested in that kind of stuff, and as it normally is my thing. And, I was wondering if you had a copy of that stuff that I could just briefly glance at. And I said, okay, sure. Look, I can tell you're from the organization. I said, I'll give you a photocopy of it. I'll put it in your mailbox, which I did. His name was Dr. David Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N. Anyway, and so I let him in on what was happening to assuage his anger and his superiors for cutting him out of the loop. But anyway, that was how things started. And then Sir John had me have other meetings. And one of the last meetings I had with him was at that Australian club, and we were joined by Sir Henry Somerset, who was a CSIRO director of the scientific organization, and a national one, and another guy, he was a like a literary professor at a university in Tasmania, I think. Anyway, there were just the four of us at the table having lunch. And after a certain point in the lunch, we were having, you know, dessert and things. And Sir John was on my right and Sir Henry was across from me. And Sir John says to Sir Henry, he says, "Henry, you know, we're losing. They're moving in on us." And he waved his hand behind him. And I thought, okay, what are they going to tell me who is? Or, and finally, there was such a silence in the conversation. I said, "Well, pardon me, who is moving in on you? Is it the, I don't know, United Nations or European Economic Community? What are you talking about?" And they looked at each other, and Sir John says, "Henry, we'll have to catch up this weekend up at the property and do some fishing." "Yes, yes." And immediately the conversation was changed and they didn't answer. And it was years later that I found out that they were talking about the aliens that were working with us on these underground bases, that they were starting to revolt. In other words, to try to get us to get out of the bases that we built for them. And that's what he was talking about. And they're moving in on us. So, amen. Long way to tell the story there, Bob. Sorry about that.
Oh, no. This is what I was talking about. You know, he has this type of knowledge he's been sharing since the mid 70s or late 70s. And, you know, as I started the question, but then I caught myself because I wanted to get that background first.
Hey, folks, Pastor Bob here. We're all out of time with today's portion with my special interview with Stan Dale. Stan is a longtime friend of this ministry, and his experiences, I mean, we're just... What you just heard in this part, like I said, I wanted to lay that down as the foundation, because for many of you, you have not heard his stories before. And folks, you know, I've interviewed him extensively. Again, I gave the references 272, 273, 274 in the episodes a couple years ago. But I'm telling you, folks, you know, this is just glossing over. This is the icing on the cake. We haven't really dove deep on this because I did those extensive interviews before. But I did want to lay that as a foundation for many of you who this might be your first time hearing about Stan Dale. Now, this is going to be a great series of interviews. You need to come back and catch every one of them because we're diving deep on government cover-ups and what is happening right now. Right now, not just in the spirit, but in the natural, how they all tie together in the end time scenario. You do not want to miss the next couple of episodes. All right, so go down to the show notes, get in touch with Stan Dale, go to his website, take a look around, order his books, order Holly's books. I'm telling you, folks, your eyes will be open to things that you did not even know were happening. I can't even begin to even try and explain how important it is that you order Stan's books. Now, come back next time. Till then, this is Pastor Bob reminding you, be blessed in all that you do. Are you a Christian entrepreneur, coach, or author with a message that needs to be heard? Picture this: your voice reaching thousands, your story inspiring hearts, and your business flourishing like never before. Introducing Faithcasters, the ultimate platform that connects faith-driven professionals like you with the power of podcasting. Become a sought-after guest on faith-based podcasts. Share your unique insights and connect with like-minded individuals who share your passion for faith and entrepreneurship as well. Imagine your expertise reaching a wider audience, expanding your network, and propelling your business to new heights. Well, it's all within reach with Faithcasters. So don't wait. Take the first step today on your journey to greatness by visiting our website at faithcaster.org. That's faithcaster.org. Join the Faithcasters community now and unleash the full potential of your faith-driven enterprise. You do not want to miss this opportunity. Faithcasters, where faith meets podcasting and your dreams become reality. Visit faithcaster.org. Let's soar together. And remember, anyone can be a podcaster, but only a Christian
can become a faith caster. Faith casters, your voice, your platform, your success.